Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mailer here. Well, in 1993, Rita Dove became the first African-American to be a U.S. Poet Laureate. And she was the youngest poet ever elected to the position. And today it's our honor to welcome her to the show. We'll talk with Rita about her latest collection of poems. And we'll talk about some other poems as well. But her latest collection is titled A Playlist for the Apocalypse. It's where she not only reveals some moments throughout history, but sheds light on her struggles with MS. So I hope you'll join in as we visit with her. Have you read Rita Dove's works? What are your favorites? Are you someone who's been inspired by Rita Dove? You can join the conversation. Easy to do. Just give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Rita Dove, good to see your smiling face. Well, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's great to be here.
So you've probably been asked this a million times, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What inspired you to become a poet?
Gosh, you know, it really was because I was reading. There were books around, and they looked intriguing, so I dived into them, and my parents were smart enough not to say, oh, you can't understand that. So I just wandered around through books like the Iliad when I was 10 years old. Of course, I didn't understand it. But the language was so melodious, and I thought, I didn't know language could do that. So I think that's where the germ, you know, was planted.
Yeah. See? When did you start?
Well, I started actually writing both short stories, like science fiction stories, because my brother, 2 years older than I, loved science fiction and got all these magazines, and I read them too. So I just began writing stories, putting little black girls in the outer space and stuff like that. Mm. And I still remember the first poem that I wrote that I was proud of. I must have been about in fourth grade, and we were supposed to do something for Easter, and something different. Everyone was supposed to express themselves. And I wrote this poem about a rabbit with a droopy ear who was sad because he had this droopy ear. And I just remember writing, you know, not knowing the end, but trying to rhyme. And I finally, you know, the language itself kind of helped me with the ending. So I was so thrilled that I solved this problem.
And then a few years later, you're a poet laureate.
Well, it does seem like, you know, the years do go faster.
So what does a poet laureate do? Writes poetry.
Well, you know, that was my question when I became poet laureate, because up to that point in time, most of the people who had been in the role of poet laureate at the Library of Congress were much older than I was, and they really sat in the poetry office and were, I guess, just official. You know, they didn't really do anything except to plan a twice a month poetry reading at the library. And at that time, everything was being recorded, so that, you know, we didn't have digitization yet. So I thought, well, that's all well and good, but you know, what does a poet laureate do? And I was kind of met with a blank stare when I asked. And so I thought, well, I'll do until they tell me don't. And luckily there were lots of people wrote in. As you mentioned, I was the first African American and the youngest in that role. And so I got lots of letters from people who were not poets and would start off saying, this is what you should do. Or else they'd say, I'm afraid of poetry, or I don't understand poetry, but, and then they would relate some amazing incident where a poem moved them at one point in their life. And I thought, you know, there's a whole bunch of people out there in this world who are afraid or think that poetry is something they can't understand, and yet they've been moved by words. And I took that as my, you know, in a way, my mission to go out in the world.
So what does it mean to you to have served as a U.S. Poet Laureate.
I still, you know, Larry, sometimes I still look back and say, did that really happen? I mean, I think all of us, you know, we carry around our childhood selves with us all the time. We have these dreams and goals, but to accomplish something that was beyond any dream that I imagined. In terms of my understanding of the world, a larger calling, it did fill me with lots of hope because I realized there were people that were trying to communicate and wanted to communicate on a deeper level than just, hi, how are you? And since that time, of course, we have social media where you can see quicker how people of all sorts of disparate, I guess you could say, cultures and tribes still connect. But at that time, that job made me into a lightning rod so that I could see a lot of things across the country. And it did fill me with hope.
Yeah. How does poetry capture the Black experience in America? This is always a deeply personal experience. It varies widely. But to your mind, how does poetry, or how can it capture that?
You know, I think it captures it. Let me give you a personal experience. When I was young and just diving into all those books on the bookshelf, 10, 11 years old, I started to read Shakespeare. And I was absolutely fascinated by the Scottish play by Macbeth. And that drive and then the guilt that follows that. I was enthralled by Romeo and Juliet. These people supposedly lived in Italy, lived in Scotland, had nothing to do with my experience. And yet I felt there was something that pulled at me. The African-American experience does, of course, have differences, to one, to say, the mainstream society. But in the end, and in the depths of our souls, we are all people who like to have a good, maybe cup of coffee or tea or whatever in the morning, who enjoy taking a clean breath of air, we're just human beings. And so my hope when I was poet laureate and my drive, I think, when I'm writing, is to write as detailed an experience as possible and trust that people will find something to connect there. So, for instance, in my book, Thomas and Beulah, which is based loosely on my grandparents' lives, I was very, very interested in trying to capture their interior life. What was it like to stand at the window and look out at someone across the street? Or what was it like to want to get just one more hour of sleep, please, before the children wake up? Yes, they were Black. They were African Americans. Yes, they lived they were lower middle class or something, very specific people. But to insist upon their humanity and their individual humanity, and then to have someone else kind of say, oh, I felt that way before. Then we know, we have a lot of common threads. So.
Well, I'm thinking of one of your poems, Family Reunion, as you talk just now, because I read that poem and I love that poem. And you know what? You took me right back to the family reunions I had. And what you wrote in that was so strikingly similar. And I hadn't thought about it in a long, long time, but it was such a pleasure to read those words and to be taken, transported back in time to all the family reunions, with Aunt Nancy's cabbage and hamburger hot dish and the kids. And you do such a wonderful job describing it. And here here we are coming up to a break. And I wish I could continue with that, but we'll come back to that and a whole lot more, Rita. Thank you. Rita Dove, our guest today. We haven't gotten to it yet, but we'll talk about her her latest wonderful work, Playlist for the Apocalypse. And you'll have a chance to join in with your questions as well. Quick look at the news. Find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, having the honor and privilege of talking with Rita Dove about her latest collection of poems, the book called A Playlist for the Apocalypse. And we're also, of course, talking her about her life as a writer. And I you know, her poems in this particular book, for me, her poems offer a glimpse of history and her personal health struggles as well. Rita, of course, an essayist, a Pulitzer Prize winner. She served as the U.S. Poet Laureate and was the first African-American to hold that title. So do you enjoy reading poetry? Are you someone who's been inspired by perhaps one of Rita's poems? Which one? I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And this book, by the way, was a finalist for the 2022 Los Angeles Times Book Prize and earned the 2021 NAACP Image Award for Outstanding Literary Work in the poetry area. So it's a wonderful book. You know, you and I are of a similar age, I think. Mm-hmm. I may be a little older. I'm not sure, but Playlist for the Apocalypse was right up my alley. I can tell you that because it covered, a lot of my life, and every poem made me stop and think about my own life and the life of our country, for sure, and maybe First, somebody wondered, well, what does apocalypse mean? And maybe you can explain, it's Playlist for the Apocalypse. In your mind, what does apocalypse symbolize?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, Larry, because I think many people, when they hear the word apocalypse, they think dystopian universe, everything is like blown to bits and we're wandering around, in some kind of science fiction-y armor. And to me, apocalypse means two things. I mean, it can mean, of course, a devastation, but the word itself comes from revelations. I mean, an apocalypse is really, when you really define it, it is something that is revealed to you that you discover that radically changes how you look at everything afterwards. So that can be positive and it can be negative and it can be something you can work with. So that was my feeling, or that was my definition of apocalypse. I wanted to adhere to this book that yes, there can be things that can be pretty awful, but also, you learn things about yourself and that changes everything you do after that.
Yeah, for sure. Maybe you could talk, I have so many themes that you explore in the book. Talk about the themes that you explore.
Yes, it's interesting because there are several different kinds of themes and there are different sections. There are poems, like you said, about my family and about the family dynamic and generations and how they work. There's a section that is about the word ghetto and how ghetto has... our idea of a ghetto has changed from the moment it was first discovered. And I think it was like in 1516 in Venice when the first ghetto was formed. But it does trace that whole word and the concept of ghetto throughout the years up to Black Lives Matter. And then there's a section called the Spring Cricket where this little cricket comments on human beings.
<You know? laughs> I love that section.
Which is compliments of my daughter when she was young, because she used to walk around singing, "No one loves me but the Spring Cricket." And we said, "Who is the Spring Cricket?" So I decided to find out. And, you know, then there are a few poems which really deal with the history of this country. They were inspired. It's called a Standing Witnesses section. It's inspired by a collaborative thing I did with a composer, Richard Daniel Poor, to do a song cycle of about 13 poems, 13 songs, which basically take care of the last 60, 70 years of American history. And that was quite a challenge to write these lyric poems that pinpoint different events along the trajectory of our country. And then there are poems about my multiple sclerosis, my personal struggle. And that's the last section, which gets very, very personal at that point. But also, I think all of us have things, adversities that we've had to struggle with, that we've chosen, that people may not know when they look at us, because we have either chosen not to say it or chosen not to bother someone. And I thought it was important to get to say that, look, this is how we negotiate that kind of world when we are dealing with chronic illnesses.
Well, and you left out the notes at the end, which I thought were they were so informative. I just love the notes, and you had me rushing back to flip back to pages to reread in a different, maybe a little bit different light. What you were writing. And so I found that so, so useful and illuminating and kind of funny in a way. And I'm remembering what was the poem? In Eight Angry Odes.
Yes.
Your students challenged you to assign yourself a poetry exercise as crazy as what, or weird or difficult as what you give to them.
And this I thought it was only fair. I do give them these wild cards where they may have to open multiple envelopes and walk out into, you know, a field and then turn around. And they said, no. If you do that to us, you know, you should do it to yourself. And I said, fair enough.
And so you wrote a poem in which I'm trying to remember this. Each line is dedicated to a different letter.
Yes. So you would have a line that all the words started with O, or all the words started with M. And I thought, oh, this will be easy, but oh, it was. It was hard. But at the same time, and I discovered why it was hard. It's hard because of the prepositions. You got an of in there, and then you messed it up.
Oh, was probably easy.
Oh, was a little easier.
Oh, well, this whole area, a standing witness, I mean, you cover the Democratic National Convention of 68. You talk about Woodstock, Watergate, Vietnam, President Obama, President Trump. It's such a broad range, but I was like my whole life here passing before my eyes. And it was such a treat to be able to read them. To you, what makes it special to you, that section?
Oh, there's so many things. One of them, Larry, is the fact, as I mentioned, it was inspired by working with Richard Daniel Poor, the composer. And I love collaborations across genres because it stretches each of us. And so when he came to me with the idea of doing a song cycle that kind of was the voice of the Statue of Liberty, actually, looking at the world and commenting on it, it was very vast and it seemed impossible. At the same time, I thought, how much time and how much of a world can you contain in one song? And the idea of the music helped carry me through. I thought it was, it immediately intrigued me what was important, what did move to the next section, how have we traveled through these years, and it helped to clarify for me that trajectory. It was so wonderful to be able to work with him and to have him send me a score of one of the songs, and then that would move me on to the next one. And it stretched me in ways that I really never thought I would. In fact, it stretched me beyond the book, because when it was finished and the mezzo-soprano Susan Graham has sung it, it's just amazing. But before it came out, of course, the pandemic came in between and postponed everything. And then Richard came to me and said, "You're going to hate me, but I think we need one more," because the pandemic had happened, right? You know, and I said, "You're right, I hate you. And you're absolutely right, we need one more." And so, in fact, it pushed me to write one more, which is not in the book because the book had already gone to press. But it's out there.
It's out there. Well, one poem you titled Woman of Flame.
Yes.
And that was recognizing Roe v. Wade, I believe. Very powerful, very visual. Maybe you could describe that poem for our listeners.
Sure. This is a poem how to describe it. I remember when I was starting to write the poem, I was trying to think of how do you bring down to the very personal something that this law that affects so many people. And so the poem does begin by just talking about various women, but never identifying, saying things like she was a mother, she was a girl who dreamed of becoming a mother. And then it goes on like that. Piling up or amassing this list of very individual people, types of people, and then moves through someone who suffers an assault and how it's always the lawyers who decided that she's free to go. So I wanted to bring to bear the idea that this is a law that covers so many different, very needful cases, and to make them human, feel human to us.
Yeah, and I think what was the last line? And she and her body were free to go.
Yes. You know, it begins. Yeah, as I said, it narrows down to one particular case where a woman has been raped, and yet she says, though she remembers the horseradish on his tongue, because I wanted to make us feel, they said none of this was she permitted to say as the court, you know, argued her case, and she and her body were free to go, with the implication, of course, that they were free to go, but she and her body, but she was going to carry that memory with her always.
Yeah. And you, another poem that stood out for Courtney Everett in particular was Trans. And maybe describe the theme. Actually, you haven't read a poem yet, and I hope you'd read one. So
I'll be happy to read this one. You said it's called Trans. Trans with a hyphen right after that. And I'll just read the poem. Trans. The moon is in doubt over whether to be a man or a woman. There have been rumors, all manner of allegations, bold claims and public lies. He's belligerent. She's in a funk. When he fades, the world teeters. When she burgeons, crime blossoms. Oh, how the operatic impulse wavers. Dig deep, my darling, into the blank pool. I wanted to, at the first, I had wanted to address or talk about the various ways in which we assign gender and took the moon as an example, because in different languages, the moon is either female or male. Some of them even have a, I speak German, and of course, the moon is their moon. It's masculine. And yet we think of her, most of the time we think of it as feminine, and that yet there's a man in the moon. So I thought, you know, instead of like freezing into our conceptions of what trans means and whether we believe in gender fluidity or not, look at what we have done in our own folklore, in our own beliefs, and how easily we can take the moon, which is there all the time, and give it different genders. So that was the fun in that.
And it's a wonderful, poem. In the last section of your book, you read about your experience with multiple sclerosis, MS. You call it a little book of woe. Mm-hmm. But your experience, well, that obviously is a very tough experience to go through. But you found some joy, or you found some, there were good parts to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother and dad were great ballroom dancers. People would stop on the dance floor and they started in and just watch them. They were so, so good at it. And you had said ballroom dancing changed your life.
It did. It did, Larry, because my particular encounters or whatever experiences with MFs involved lack of losing all of the feeling in my extremities, fingers, toes, and calves, and some other things, loss of muscle control, which has been blessedly brought under control. But I still can't feel my fingers and my toes. So it was difficult to walk, let's put it that way. And learning how to, I was learning how to ballroom dance at the time. And through that dancing, actually, it's very strange. Through that dancing, I learned a different way of feeling pressure as opposed to actually feeling it. I could sense the weight, and that helped me learn to keep a steady gait and to dance, and so I realized how resilient is the body. I mean, it just keeps relearning things. It did bring me joy and in a certain way saved my life.
Yeah, well, it was. There were so many times in so many of the stories within your poems that just brought experiences that I've had to share that and reminded me of times that were a lot of them really good and we've not dealt enough on the spring cricket and some of the poems that were so joyful in so many ways, but that also made you think about things a bit. But I had so many times where I laughed or I had a big smile on my face a lot of the time. What do you? And here I am. You know, here we are, about the same age, but. There are, in my mind, in your book, there are so many things for people of any age, and I wonder, and you know, this book it's such a wonderful. It's going to be around forever. That's one of the great things that we have is that this book will be around forever. What do you hope future generations can learn or will learn from reading this, your works, this book?
Well, you know, first of all, I do hope, Larry, that in some way these poems will touch them and that they can say, oh, the past is not past. The past is just in a certain way, a mirror and an echo of how we live today. There, you cannot shelve events and say they just happened and that will never happen to us. In that theme, I'm hoping that they can see that even events that are talked about in this book or that are way in the past, you know, let's just say back in the Jewish ghetto or even early, that they do speak to something in our characters as humans, which could serve as a warning or as a learn or just as something to think about too, because history does repeat itself in because we are human beings and we do wrestle with the same fears and joys throughout the centuries. I'm hoping that that book speaks to some of their fears and joys and they can think of it as a companion, as their lives. Let's hope.
So you had quite a hiatus there between books. Are you working on another one too?
Yes, I am. I am working on another book. I did have a long a spell between books. Part of that was because I was working with trying to figure out how to write again, because I used to write by hand. I love that physical quality and I can't really do it anymore because of the MS. So I had to figure out how to use dictation and to write on the screen, which I, you know, didn't want to do. It's too permanent for somehow. And so I figured it took a while. But now I knock on wood. I have some systems worked out. And so I've been writing. I'm working on a memoir, which is a daunting kind of task. But it's
well,
so hard.
you better promise me you'll come back and talk when that finishes.
I promise.
Rita, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for being
Thank
with
you
us.
Larry. Thank you.
It was fun. Rita Dove, our guest today, and her book, Playlist for the Apocalypse. I hope you have a chance to look at it. And I hope you have a chance to stay with us right through the afternoon. Many good things in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mealer.